In the program, it should say Pete Landold is the co-author, because a lot of this work we've done together, and he really helps me quite a bit. He's really the one that started a lot of this, the chemical ecology of yellow jackets. Some ways we're kind of in our infancy here when we're dealing with the social insects of the yellow jackets, the Vespaini. We're nowhere near in terms of development of the chemical ecology, food attractants, and pheromones that we've seen in some of the groups we've talked about before. I'm going to try to focus primarily on the Vespaini, the yellow jackets, and not really talk about Polistes and the hornets that much. The yellow jackets, there's a dolichal vespula, generally has aerial nests and vespula underground nests. The paper wasps, smaller colonies, open-faced. They don't have this covering of envelope around them. The yellow jackets can have fairly large colonies, anywhere from just a few hundred maybe to several thousand. Generally annual colony cycle. As we get more subtemperate or even tropical, we can almost get perennial colonies there. So in those cases, and in some of the areas where it's become invasive, certain yellow jackets can be a real major problem. The ones that are most concerned to homeowners and recreation areas are those what we call scavenge. Of course, they scavenge, as we'll see, for both carbohydrate sources and food or protein sources. But there are a set of species that seem to go primarily to meat and also sugars. But when you talk about the scavenging yellow jackets, usually talking about those going to protein sources. And we probably all encountered these at different sites, either forest sites, hiking, recreational areas, picnics, garbage containers, and it's this context where humans get in more contact with yellow jackets, and we swat at them as they're trying to take our sandwich, that we get stung. And there are a few species that seem to nest in more close proximity with human and human structures there. So what are some of the attractants, potential sources of attractants? So we're dealing with a social insect. We're dealing with a generalist predator, as well as a generalist carbohydrate feeder. It has a colony in which there's a nutritional status of the colony. So and there's learning probably involved here. So there's a lot of factors that are impinging upon their feeding, their activity. Some of the things that we've noticed, probably there's fruity esters that are involved. They're attracted to decaying fruit, and hence we'll talk about what Pete came up with, the fermenting molasses extracts. Prey volatiles, this shows a Polistes here feeding on Heliothis, but Polistes primarily hit caterpillars, but yellow jackets will feed on a wide variety of arthropods and oftentimes flies. And then here we see an example of honeydew here from New Zealand in some of these beech forests that I'll refer to later on that have a high concentration of homopterans, a lot of honeydew that attracts the invasive yellow jacket there. So these are some of the potential sources for foraging attractants for the yellow jackets. They don't go to flowers that much. You will see yellow jackets in the paper wasp here feeding on nectaries with flowers, and Pete's had a student that worked on peony floral scents, and in an olfactometer study had Polistes dominulus attracted to these floral extracts here. So this is a potential source as well in some cases. We have a number of carbonated drinks that everybody likes to use and says that this is the best drink for attracting yellow jackets, and I've heard that you use the pop can here, and they can call it the Buckeye or the Ohio trapping method. And sometimes these are very, very effective. Good sugar source. They're not sure what the role of the CO2 is in there as well. So there's probably some, maybe volatiles involved here. The other area with the scavenging species, those that come to protein sources, such as a cat food, as you see here, or fish or meat, your sandwich, they can respond very rapidly, we're not sure if there's some communication that's involved back with the colony, but can really rapidly respond to a meat source. But it's a very temporal nature. It very quickly, the meat becomes rancid. There must be a whole volatility change here of chemicals coming off, and it doesn't last that long. our colleagues in New Zealand and others that have worked with protein baits incorporated with insecticide there for population suppression have found that these protein baits, you know, work well in certain situations, but they're not always attractive, not in all habitats, not in all seasons. There's a short life in the field, so there's difficulty with the shelf life here. And of course, they're looking at sometimes these invasive species in Australia and New Zealand that are widespread and higher populations than maybe what we deal with. And they're looking for aerial application. It's really tough to do that with fresh protein. So it'd be great to try to get some potential attractants or volatile compounds from protein baits. Our colleagues in Argentina that have also worked with invasive Germanica, yellowjack in Argentina, have demonstrated here, as you can see with their data here, that it wasn't just meat that they're attracted to, but in the presence of meat, there seems to be a head pheromone or an extract of Germanica deposited at these food stations that enhance the attractiveness. So is there a food marking or head pheromone, if you will, involved with some of these scavenging species such as Germanica? That's another potential source here. So the idea is, we have natural products, but what are some of the compounds that are attractive? Years ago, Harry Davis in the Yakima lab, when it was in Yakima, not in Wapato, tested a large variety of esters and came up with heptylbutyrate and 2,4-hexadienyl butyrate that worked for some of the western species, Pennsylvanica and Atropellosa specifically, and it's been tested in other places in my neck of the woods in Oklahoma, Squamosa. It's been very effective, and also in throughout the southeast. Aldrich has come up with a mixture from a prey volatile of the stink bug pheromone, linalool, and some of its the other two compounds here that seem to attract macula fronds and vidua, two species here. Now macula fronds would be more of the scavenging species. So again, an example of a prey volatile that's bringing in some of these yellowjack potential predators. But Pete, with a number of, a little help from me and others, worked with this idea of fermenting molasses, some of these carbohydrate sources, and isolated these co-attractants, acetic acid and isobutanol. And this has already been mentioned before, but I think he realized he was getting a lot of things in these traps, and we were getting flies, he was getting moths, and getting yellow jackets. And so he's trying to sort out which of the different volatiles were involved here. And we've heard about the noctuid moths and a little about the muscoid flies, but it was this isobutanol and acetic acid combination that isobutanol isomers as well, that bring in these yellow jackets and are pretty effective for bringing in vespinae. And so we've done tests, and I've done in Oklahoma, Pete in Washington State, I guess in Maryland and Michigan. We've gone to Alaska, and we've gone to a lot of different places, and this is not an exhaustive list, but it shows some of the species that are attracted to this these co-attractants, and the ones in red are those that are probably larger colony size, more tendency to scavenge, or be in presence with humans, and those are the ones that be more of the target species. Already done? No. What bell is that? If we look at heptylbutyrate, one of the earlier attractants, has more of a narrow group of species that are attracted. Pennsylvanica is fairly unique, the western yellow jacket that is attracted to this. It seems to be primarily attracted for some of the smaller colony species like Acatic, Consobrina, Vidua, and Rufa that are tend not to scavenge at meat sources. Squamosa in the south can get large colonies, so sometimes it could be considered pestiferous there. And that's attracted to heptylbutyrate. Well, the experimental design that we've used is this dome trap-it design, and again, trying to focus on what type of attractant, how much, and what ratio. Pete's mentioned before using these vials here with the vial cap diameter dictating the release rate, determining the release rate. So the larger the diameter, obviously, the more compound that's released. So using this experimental design, we try to ask a lot of questions over the years about what's a good lure, what's a good bait for the yellow jackets. Well, obviously the chemical makeup of the lure. It's pretty obvious we need to come up with a good attractants here. But the other thing is how much, the chemical release rate. We can't just put fermented molasses out there. We get a whole bunch of things. We don't know what's exactly the volatile attractants there. So trying to come up, isolating and come up with a good release rate formulation or dispenser. And if we have a couple compounds like the acetic acid and isobutanol together, you know, what's the ratio of those? Should those be 3-1, 1-3, 1-1? And so that's some of the questions that we all should look at. Trap design, trap placement. Yellow jackets are very visual predators. Color is important. And we can see the importance of traps there. Is that my time too? Okay. We also look at regional and a specific response. Different species respond differently. We want to hit the target species and not non-target species. That's why we've been fortunate. I work in Michigan in the summer, so I can do some studies in Michigan, Oklahoma, and Pete's in Washington State. At the same time, looking at local ecological factors, what I want to kind of look at. But look at release rate. For a long time, we used heptylbutyrate in commercial traps, just put it on a cotton ball. But you can see this is the milligrams per day over a period of time. After 7 days, our release rate goes down pretty quickly. We're not really controlling how much is being released out there. So with this a vial with a hole diameter, and you see the different size of the holes here, we can see roughly we're getting a fairly constant release rate for as long as 4 weeks in this period of time. So we're able to control the release rate by the diameter, and it can last longer than a cotton ball or some other type of free open volatile system here. This is for isobutanol, and you can see the same thing even at the high dose. Each of those, it's kind of at least 3 weeks here. It's starting to drop off after 21 days, the milligrams per hour there. So we have a system that can control the release rate here. What about the ratio? We got acetic acid and isobutanol together. What's the ideal ratio of these two compounds that have been isolated from the fermenting molasses? Well, in this case, he's held isobutanol constant of a 0.12 inch diameter and varied the acetic acid vial diameter hole here. And you can see the different wasps that are attracted over time. And really, it comes almost down to a 1-1 ratio is the best for our yellow jackets. So that's kind of what we've then continued to use after this. So that's important to look at. And we know, as we've heard before, release rates affects attractancy. This is work that we've done with my students in Oklahoma with two species there, Squamosa and Maculifrons. This is, again, a hole size as we go up. You think more is better, but you get to a too large of a diameter hole, too large volatility, or too much dose, if you will, 22 millimeter size, we get actually suppression of capture for both these species here. So, and actually there was no statistical difference for Maculifrons between the 3 and the 12 in there. So in terms of size, diameter there. So release rate does affect the attractancy. We've done this with Squamosa. Squamosa is more is better. I don't know if we can get any larger than the 33 millimeter diameter. We have to get a larger vial. Just the heptylbutyrate, it just seems to keep going and keep going. And so more seems to be better for this species, again, for this species, for this particular attractant. So you have to really kind of hammer this in each particular area, each particular species, and for your compound you're looking at. Well, if one of our butyrates is good, maybe we can find another butyrate that's better. Heptylbutyrate is the one that's was documented early on. There's some hint that octyl and hexylbutyrates were good attractants. And again, I was looking at the southern yellow jacket. So we looked at a range of butyrate compounds here, from the smaller ones to the larger ones, and see if we could come up with any better results. And we really couldn't. It still seemed like hexylbutyrate right here and the heptylbutyrate were still the best attractants for Squamosa. And they were all at the same dose here. Or at least in Oklahoma. Well, and we also have hinted at this before, some species are attracted preferentially to heptylbutyrate and not to acetic acid isobutanol. What we try to do here with the two species in Oklahoma is try to get our best dose of acetic acid isobutanol compared against our best dose of heptobutyrate, which is 33 millimeter dose. And you can see squamosa, this was just barely significant, still preferred acetic acid isobutanol, but we mucilafrons will not go at all, not attracted at all to heptobutyrate. So we do have to be concerned about the specific responses in the different localities, especially when you're dealing with maybe a place like in Washington State and Michigan where there's 8 to 9, maybe a dozen different species of yellow jackets. Well, what about what do we combine some of these together? And we've heard about additive effects and synergistic effects. This is some work Pete did in New Zealand when he went down there to work on the invasive vulgaris. And we combined acetic acid isobutanol with heptobutyrate, with linalool, and then other components of that stink bug pheromone. And unfortunately, in this test, we were just getting suppression. So we weren't getting any additive effect, any synergistic effect. It was almost more of a suppression here. And then I did this in Oklahoma with squamosa. I didn't do the stink bug pheromone, but I added heptobutyrate together with acetic acid isobutanol, and I'm just not getting anything better, you know. Heptobutyrate and hexobutyrate were probably the best for squamosa in this study, and wasn't getting any additive effect by adding acetic acid isobutanol here. So seemed to be a little more suppression. Although Aldrich has a paper, it has worked with acetic acid isobutanol and his stink bug pheromone, has gotten some synergism, or at least additive effect. But again, we got a point I'm going to get to here eventually is the ecological factors and the feeding situations of each locality. Effective trap design, I won't go into this, but we've done a lot of studies looking at different trap designs. And Sterling, I think, maybe being in the audience, they've got a new trap here. But there's plenty of traps to try to come up with a better attractancy. So don't use the safer trap. What we kind of went back to this past summer was trying to think, well, let's look at our synthetic attractants we have, but are we missing something in this natural attractant? Or is there something missing in the fermenting apple juice? So with some students who did some work in northern Michigan, which is a pine forest, white pine forest, and deciduous hardwood forest, and we did it in July and August, which is pretty good, their peak time for yellow jackets there. So we compared our optimal dose of heptobutyrate and acetic acid isobutanol to just our good old fermenting apple juice, putting it out there and see what we get, including moths there. So in Michigan, here's three of the species that are more of the pestiferous scavenger species, and lo and behold, our numbers were not great that year. We didn't have real good high populations, but we did get significant difference. And the apple juice was more of a better attractant than acetic acid isobutanol for Flaviculosa mucilafrons vulgaris, and again, in this context. We looked at these other smaller non-pestiferous species, Acatica, Consobrina, and Vidua, and for two of the species, Vidua and Consobrina, we got apple juice at significant levels there too, although, the Vidua was very highly attracted to heptobutyrate. But again, a hint that something's going on more in the apple juice we're not picking up. These species are not usually attracted at all to acetic acid isobutanol. The dolichal vespula that haven't been that strongly attracted to the acetic acid isobutanol mix, we did pick those up in good numbers, significant numbers over any of the other two baits in the apple juice. So maybe there's something there that's going to pick up dolichal vespula. So I did this in Oklahoma. So I came back, you know, and go back to the hot summer in Oklahoma, but yellow jackets don't start kicking in till later in the fall. And actually we had a pretty good mild fall and was able to go to November 5th. So we were looking at the same study, looked at heptobutyrate, acetic acid isobutanol, and the apple juice for squamosa and mucilafrons. And in this case, we were getting a more significant response to acetic acid isobutanol than the apple juice. And so the question is, well, we had two species that were the same between Michigan and Oklahoma. In Michigan, the northern pine forest, in Oklahoma, the cross timbers and kind of a post-oak savanna. And you can see that in Michigan, this is from Mucula fronds, the apple juice was a lot better than acetic acid isobutanol, and we got the reverse in Oklahoma. So why? I mean, there's a lot of differences that may come about, result in this, the habitat differences. We can have different available food sources here, different time of the colony cycle. Even though later in the cycle, even though Michigan is a lot, there's colony cycle ends before they do in Oklahoma, they're both kind of towards the end, but we were going way into the fall, late fall in Oklahoma. And Pete ran some of these similar type studies in Washington State here, and this is Pennsylvanica. Strongly attracted to heptalbutyrate, not as great to the apple juice. This is total average captures at a number of localities in, around Yakima. Then he also looked at other species here. And it, again, it was kind of interesting. We've got a couple here of vulgaris and maculata, which showed up, again, more attraction here to the apple juice than to the heptalbutyrate or acetic acid isobutanol. So there's something going on, possibly in this fermenting apple juice. There could possibly be more additional attractive compounds in these fermenting natural carbohydrate sources. We see obvious species differences, and the thing I want to keep in mind, the more I keep doing this in different areas, that there's a lot of variation in the ecological situation. What are the available food sources? How can my synthetic bait compete with the natural resource, natural sources out there? And there's a lot of these things that may have an impact. And in that light, what I'd like to do is just bring up some work just briefly. How much time do I have? I'm okay? All right. From Jacqueline Beggs in New Zealand, where they deal with the large colonies of an invasive Vespula vulgaris. And they have beech forests there that have an abundant sugar source, a honeydew. And when they try sugar-based baits in these honeydew areas, they just don't work. They cannot compete with these natural food sources. So sugar baits are only attractive in the non-honeydew areas. And then also they're doing protein bait, meat baits with an insecticide, and it's kind of the opposite effect. The protein baits are highly attractive to the wasp in these honeydew-laden New Zealand forests. So you can see the honeydew is present here. In those sites, and this is mean number of wasps per protein bait of trap, we're getting the protein. They may be carbohydrate rich, but they're probably protein starved. So this is another situation. It's hard to figure out, you know, out in the field, what are you competing with for their natural food sources, since they're such good generalists here. So there's plenty of future research to do. Pete and I keep joking that, you know, we're the old guys. We need some new guys coming in here and doing some stuff. So you don't have to listen to us talk all the time about this, but look at the role of habitat, seasonality, what are available food sources on bait attractiveness, looking at additional attractants in fermenting sugar sources. I think an exciting thing is meat and fish volatile isolation identification. You chemists would know a lot more about that, but a whole host of volatiles that change very quickly. You know, you have your salmon out there, and it smells good now, well, fishy. And then it smells rancid pretty quickly. So there's a real rapid change of volatility there. And what about new combinations and ratios of some of the compounds we have? And of course, the long-term targeting pestiferous species, trying to develop some encapsulated insecticide with these synthetic attracted baits. So just like to acknowledge Roger Akery, they got both Pete and I into yellow jackets, and just appreciate him so much, and many, many students that I can't turn any of them into entomologists. They're all going on practicing medicine. So, Pete, thank you. Have time for questions?
Yeah, we have time for a couple questions.
All right, time for a question. Yes, Bob.
The fish-based attractants, have you looked at, there's at least a human olfaction, there's a classical compound that is indicative of strength of the fishy smell.
Yeah. And that would be monodiene,
trimethylamine, trimethylamine,
fought out
the protein. The smell is actually sharp. It's extremely strong.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the dye, it's more of a macro level.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah.
You might want to just look at those.
Yeah, we haven't looked at those, but
not the other. Have you looked at the dive meter? No, the try might be a little bit. You don't know how to spell my last name. So.
Justin.
Now, have you looked at the difference in Oklahoma and Michigan when you were doing, I think it was tequila fronds and apple juice? Have you looked at the fermentation of flora in those two pools of apple juice? That may give you a hint as to, you know, what's going on.
Yeah. Right, the degree of fermentation going on in the
No, we haven't
looked at what organisms are there. No, and the degree of fermentation we're not controlling at all in that system. You know, so that's a good question, though.
Very, very good point, because it's also an issue with the molasses.
Yeah.
Because we have to use diluted molasses to grow microbes and make it attractive, and there's got to be different things going on, and who gets there first?
Yeah.
Which
could
put a lot of
areas
in
versus Oklahoma. Yeah, see if there's different. Bob again?
There's a lot of work that's going on in Europe on these darn apple volatile juices. And there's some more work, that's for the fruit bugs. And I don't think they've actually, broken it out, other than the fact that you can't use obviously pasteurized apple juice.
Good.